this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Life and Trials of Samuel Green by Victor Lookerson. Born enslaved, he lost his freedom a second time for the crime of owning a book. The knock on Samuel Green's door must have felt inevitable. It was April 1857, and in the past decade, hundreds of black Marylanders had shipped off the farms and plantations where they were enslaved. New local white leaders were beginning to suspect that Green knew more about the runaways than he let on. Green was a free black man who lived in a cottage in Dorchester County on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay, where he farmed a modest plot and preached the word of God. Opening his door that April evening, Green came face to face with the law. "You are suspected of holding correspondence with the North," a county sheriff told him, "and I shall search your house." The sheriff and his posse soon found what they were looking for: a letter from Green's son, Sam Jr., a map of Canada, railroad schedules for northbound trains, and a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe's blockbuster anti-slavery novel, published 5 years earlier. None of the items proved that Green had helped usher anyone to freedom, but the book turned out to be sufficiently incriminating. Green was placed under arrest. And he was charged under an obscure Maryland law with possessing a quote-unquote abolition pamphlet that could, quote, create discontent amongst the people of color of this state, end quote. As he sat in a jail cell awaiting his trial, state prosecutors began to craft an ominous argument. A person caught reading the wrong kind of book deserved to be locked away. It was no accident that Green's unprecedented case unfolded in Maryland, where slavery's position at the center of American life was at its most tenuous. Maryland had the largest free black population of any state in the nation. It was also the state from which the greatest number of people fled slavery. Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, who may have been a distant relative of Green's, among them. Trapped between the slavery-powered economy of the South and the industrial North, black people in Maryland had long negotiated freedom however they could. During the Revolutionary War, enslaved Marylanders escaped to British ships anchored in the Chesapeake Bay after Virginia's colonial governor, Lord Dunmore, offered emancipation to enslaved people who defected to the British Army. After the war, some of Dorchester County's white leaders proposed abolishing slavery in the state, following the lead of neighboring Pennsylvania. The effort failed, but individual enslavers freed more than 1,600 enslaved people in the county before 1820. Most of the manumission stemmed from the strong strain of Methodism in Maryland and the abolitionist teachings of John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist Church. With some restrictions, the earliest of these formerly enslaved people entered a Maryland society where they could vote, own property, and testify in court. Green was born in bondage around 1802 in East New Market, a village in northeast Dorchester County. He worked as a farm laborer and may have been hired out to work on other farms, an arrangement that sometimes gave enslaved people the chance to keep a portion of the fee they earned. Before Green's enslaver, Henry Nichols, died in 1832, Nichols decreed in his will that Green be freed 5 years after his death. Green refused to wait. By working long hours, he raised enough money to purchase his liberty from Nichols's beneficiaries within a year. In 1842, he purchased the freedom of his wife, Kitty, for $100, though their two children, Sam Jr. and Sarah, remained enslaved. Green and Kitty joined Maryland's growing number of free black people, who totaled more than 40% of the black population by 1840. Many worked as laborers, others as blacksmiths, butchers, carpenters, and in other skilled trades. Nearly 2,500 free black Marylanders were property owners. Green himself, mild-mannered, literate, and devoutly religious, spent much of his time spreading the gospel. He was a licensed exhorter, a role in the Methodist Church that allowed him to preach to black people, both free and enslaved. He also served as a founding trustee for a church in East New Market, the Colored People's Methodist Episcopal Church. Black and white Marylanders acknowledged his contributions to the community, calling him intelligent and exceedingly useful in contemporaneous accounts. He was able to build skills and build relationships beyond Henry Nichols's plantation, says Kate Clifford Larson, the author of the Harriet Tubman biography, Bound for the Promised Land, and an expert on the Underground Railroad. He had networks of people, and that helped him navigate the world. But even as Green eked out a life for himself and his wife, he witnessed a growing racial backlash as Maryland steadily turned against its earlier notions of black liberty. Voting rights had been completely stripped from black men in 1810, following the loss of the right to testify in court. The pace of manumissions had slowed as the Methodist Church dropped calls for abolition in order to appease wealthy white enslavers, who broke off from the larger church to form a southern faction that endorsed slavery. Many enslavers began selling black Marylanders to the plantations of the Deep South as demand for field labor grew with the rise of the cotton crop. Others became fervent supporters of the so-called colonization movement, a decades-long effort to ship black Americans to Africa. Discrimination in Maryland increased in the 1830s after Nat Turner's failed rebellion in Virginia. Maryland lawmakers launched sweeping efforts to limit the mobility of both the free and the enslaved. Free black people from other states were banned from entering Maryland, and religious gatherings were outlawed unless they were overseen by white clergymen. Another law decreed that black sailors could no longer operate large boats. In 1851, a new Maryland state constitution enshrined protections to life, liberty, and property for white men, and ominously granted the legislature the power of regulation and disposition of the free colored population, as they may deem necessary. Hardly a session of the legislature passes that some law is not enacted, restricting free black people and their rights and privileges, a legislative committee noted in the report from the era. Maryland's impositions mirrored the nation's. The Fugitive Slave Act, passed in 1815, required that runaways in free states be returned to their enslavers, often by federally sanctioned slave catchers. Horror stories spread of runaways or even free black people kidnapped as far north as Philadelphia or Boston and shipped south. Slaveholders mean to cling to their slaves as long as they can and to the bitter end, remarked Frederick Douglass, who, like Green, had been born and enslaved on Maryland's eastern shore. They show no sign of a wish to quit their iron grasp upon the sable throats of their victims. Green observed these developments with alarm. Though he climbed out of slavery, he saw that even he and his free neighbors in Dorchester County were not truly free. He would later recall an incident where a white Marylander told him that he'd rather go to hell and be damned than to go to heaven with a N-word. Green began doing what he could to upend the evil of slavery, as he later put it, attending conferences like the Convention of Free Colored People in Baltimore, where black leaders debated the best course of action in a darkening social climate. But with two fully grown children who were still enslaved, he came to feel that it wasn't enough to talk. By 1854, Green's son, Samuel Green Jr., could no longer stand a life in bondage. He and his sister, Sarah, by then in their mid-20s, had been sold several years earlier to James Muse, a Dorchester County physician Sam Jr. called the worst man in Maryland, on account of his vicious whippings and abuse. One day late that summer, Sam Jr. visited his father. "I must fly for freedom," he told him. Sam Jr. had already been mulling an escape for months, since he had met a local runaway who had managed to flee and then shockingly returned to help free others. Newspaper ads demanding the runaway's capture called her Minty, but the Greens and the rest of America would eventually know her as Harriet Tubman. Tubman hailed from the Dorchester County community of Bucktown, about 9 miles southwest of Sam Green's home. Her escape in September 1849 was not unusual. In the 1850 census, Maryland recorded 279 runaways, more than anywhere else in the Union. Over the next decade, nearly 100 more would flee from Dorchester County alone. These runaways faced brutal repercussions if captured. Some received 20 lashes from their captors and more beatings when they were returned to their enslavers. Others were branded with an R for runaway on their cheek. Packs of Maryland bloodhounds were often contracted to catch escapees through the state. Most of those who made it out never returned to the Eastern Shore. Tubman came back again and again. On at least 13 return trips to Maryland, she guided some 70 people to freedom and aided dozens more with advice about optimal escape routes, often conveyed in coded messages via songs. She became the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. "I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger," she said later. Tubman often worked to free members of her extended family through Dorchester County. She tended to bring them through a rural area called Poplar Neck along the Choptank River in neighboring Caroline County, where her parents, also agents of the Underground Railroad, lived. From there, she would guide her runaway companions by foot or wagon over the Delaware border to Dover, then to Wilmington, and eventually into Philadelphia and beyond. Sometimes she traveled north by boat to Baltimore and through the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. The journeys typically ended in the city of St. Catharines in Ontario, where hundreds of liberated people eventually settled. In the spring of 1854, while she was back in Dorchester to rescue her brothers, Tubman gave Sam Jr. instructions on the best route to Philadelphia. Sam Jr. then worked up the courage to tell his father. Soon afterward, he fled. From Canada, he wrote home to his father, urging more enslaved people to follow. "Tell P. Jackson to come on, Bailey to come on," Sam Jr. wrote. "Come more." It's not clear when the elder Green became involved with the Underground Railroad. He may have already been working as an agent on the secretive network before his son fled, or his son's plight under a violent enslaver may have motivated him to do more to combat slavery. Whatever the case, he became a partner in Tubman's many rescues. He shared a surname with Tubman's mother and may have been a distant relative, according to Larson, the Tubman scholar. Green's home, just west of East New Market, became a refuge where runaways could hide from police and vigilantes hunting for them. And thanks to his relationship to the Methodist Church, he had connections to friendly black and white residents along the Eastern Shore. Green was important enough to her missions that Tubman mentioned him by name when late in life she recalled her most common Underground Railroad routes in an interview with the historian William Siebert. "People like Tubman, heroes that we celebrate, they never do anything all on their own," Larson says. "She could not have done what she did without the help of other people." The escape of Sam Jr.'s friend, Joe Bailey, was among the most dramatic Tubman helped orchestrate, and Green played a key role. Bailey, an enslaved lumber foreman tasked with chopping timber along the Choptank River, was regularly whipped by his enslaver, a business magnate named William Hewlett. Bailey and his brother Bill enlisted Tubman's help to run away. The route north from Dorchester County usually took 3 or 4 days. But it took Tubman and the Bailey brothers more than 2 weeks due to long periods of hiding from slave catchers. Joe Bailey had an exorbitant $1,500 bounty on his head. Green opened his home to Tubman and the Baileys as their pursuers scoured the region. Once in Wilmington, the group enlisted the help of some local black bricklayers who hid them in a secret compartment of their wagon while they rode past patrolling police. The group eventually made it to safety in Canada. But the growing number of escapees incensed the Eastern Shore's enslaver class. With suspicion turning on the region's free black population, black schools without white supervision were banned, and police searches of black people's homes became common. Whispers about Green's involvement into the Underground Railroad grew louder after every escape. There is no doubt of the fact that Green was instrumental and had been for a long time in the escapes of slaves from this county. The Easton Gazette, a pro-slavery paper in nearby Talbot County, editorialized after his arrest. After Sam Jr. escaped, his sister Sarah was sold to an enslaver on the Missouri frontier as an apparent punishment, separating her from her husband and two small children. No records indicate that the Greens ever spoke to Sarah again. Desperate for the remaining family members to reunite, Sam Jr. wrote a letter imploring his father to let us all live together here in Canada. In the winter of 1856-57, Green secretly traveled to Ontario to see his son and assess whether the family could earn a living in the far north. When he returned, he told Kitty to prepare to leave Dorchester County for good. But Green had not been as discreet as he imagined. The Easton Gazette later reported that local enslavers found out about his trip to Canada, when shortly after he returned, a group of local enslaved people known as the Dover Eight made a dramatic escape, gaining national attention and embarrassing the community's enslavers. They took action. Having identified Green as a suspect, they now focused on conjuring the necessary evidence and latched on to Uncle Tom's cabin as the proof they needed. The red brick Dorchester County Courthouse was the opulent centerpiece of the county seat of Cambridge. But for black Marylanders, the building was another symbol of terror. Frequent human auctions were conducted outside, with merchants of flesh placing bids on enslaved men, women, and children from a hotel veranda across the street. Inside the courthouse in the spring of 1857, prosecutors began to build their case against Green. They seized on an 1841 act applied only once before that outlawed the possession of inflammatory materials that could create discontent or foment insurrection among the black population. The law only impacted free black people, another sign of how much Maryland lawmakers feared their growing presence in the state. White people were free to read and write abolitionist material, though they could be punished for failing to inform the police if they knew free black Marylanders who were violating the law. At first, state attorneys focused on the map and the railroad schedules that police had found in Green's home. But Green's defense argued that the documents had such a broad use, they could not be narrowly defined as abolitionist or otherwise used to sow discontent among Dorchester County's enslaved population. The judge agreed, and Green was found not guilty on this indictment. The prosecutors next turned to his copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. In the 5 years since its publication, the novel had gripped Northern readers with its unflinching account of slavery's brutalities and its humanizing portrayals of its enslaved characters. 2 million copies had been sold by the time of Green's trial. In the South, however, enslavers, pro-slavery newspapers, and other civic leaders rallied against the text, arguing that it was radicalizing black people and indoctrinating white children. In Athens, Georgia, copies of the book were burned. In Mobile, Alabama, vigilantes reportedly forced a bookseller to flee town after he featured the novel in his shop. But only Maryland was attempting to throw someone in jail for owning it. Green had been given his copy by a blacksmith only a few months earlier, according to a newspaper account, when he was headed to the local mill. Before that chance encounter, he wasn't even aware of the book, and at the time of his arrest, he hadn't yet finished reading it. But prosecutors insisted that the trial was more about the objects seized from Green's home. The novel, they argued, threatened the very foundation of their society. If the legitimacy of slavery began to crumble, the Union would go with it. Slavery must be protected or it must be abolished, the assistant counsel argued for the state. The gambit worked. The same judge who had earlier ruled in Green's favor now ruled that Uncle Tom's Cabin, a work of fiction, met the criteria of an abolitionist pamphlet described in the 1841 law. Green, born into enslavement, then freed at 30, was now sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was immediately transferred to Baltimore, Maryland State Penitentiary. The news of the verdict made waves across the country. In South Carolina, a Charleston Courier columnist argued that the facts were so unreasonable that Northern abolitionists must have made them up to demonize the planter class. Too impossible and absurd to be anything but false, he wrote. Other Southerners welcomed Green's imprisonment, with the Easton Gazette calling it a righteous verdict. Northern writers used Green's arrest to illustrate how poisonous slavery had become, corrupting basic rights to free expression. All the annals of Spanish or Roman inquisitions could not show a more degrading fact, fumed an editorial in the New Bedford Mercury in Massachusetts. The Liberator, the abolitionist paper founded by William Lloyd Garrison, castigated the Maryland lawmakers who had passed a statute capable of being abused for so cruel and tyrannical a purpose. In Kansas, the Lawrence Republican wrote that Green's conviction was a burning disgrace upon the civilization, upon the age, and especially upon the character and name of our nation. But not even widespread outrage would get Green out of prison. Green hoped for a pardon from a pair of successive Maryland governors, Thomas Watkins Leagon and Thomas Holliday Hicks, the second of whom was a Dorchester County native whom Green later claimed to know personally. Two dozen local farmers, merchants, and teachers in the East New Market area quickly signed a petition seeking clemency for Green. A group of Maryland ministers did the same, while 114 Methodist clergymen from as far away as New York rallied to Green's cause with their own petition. But Leagon and Hicks, under pressure from local enslavers, both refused to help Green. If Green's imprisonment was meant to deter runaways and the networks that aided them, it didn't work. In October 1857, 6 months after Green's arrest, a group of 28 runaways escaped Dorchester County at one time. Escapes continued into 1858. Tubman kept returning until 1860, seeking to rescue her sister Rachel and other relatives. By then, the country was careening toward war. At the start of 1861, after seven southern states voted to secede from the Union, Maryland was torn over what to do. Many people in Maryland were Confederate sympathizers, but the state was deeply divided over entering the war. Because of Maryland's strategic position bordering the capital, President Abraham Lincoln took steps to ensure federal control. After state legislators voted against secession in April, Baltimore was placed under martial law anyway, and the federal government largely controlled state governance throughout the Civil War. Green remained imprisoned as war broke out, but in 1862, his fortunes finally reversed. A Union loyalist named Augustus Bradford was elected governor of Maryland. One of his confidants was Francis Thompson King, a well-connected Baltimore Quaker who had taken an interest in Green's plight. King visited Green in prison and advised Bradford on Green's case multiple times. Many petitions demanding Green's release from Methodist leaders and East New Market locals were also still on the books. At the collective urging of Methodist and Quaker ministers, Bradford pardoned Green as one of his first official actions as governor. On April 21, 1862, Green finally walked free for the second and last time. 3 months later, Green stood before an expectant crowd outside Boston. "I have been truly gratified in hearing what has been said in regard to the evil of slavery," he declared, "and the terrible consequences thereof, which now convulse the nation." America was changing fast. In a few months, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation would nominally free the nation's slaves, but not in border states that remained in the Union, such as Maryland. Green would have had understood better than most how what was legal and what was just could often be at odds. Even in the case of his own pardon, one of the stipulations that he would leave the state of Maryland within 60 days. He was 60 years old now, but younger in spirit. The Liberator described him as good-looking, intelligent, and amiable. Though he had still hoped to join his son in Canada, he had little money, so he traveled the Northeast on a makeshift lecture tour, handing out a collection plate after each speech to help fund a new life. In Philadelphia, he sat down with William Still, a devoted chronicler of the enslaved people who traveled the Underground Railroad. In New York, he gave a speech that was mentioned by the New York Times. That summer, he also got to meet a pivotal figure in his life, Harriet Beecher Stowe. He visited the novelist in her home and told her of his travails since stumbling upon her book. "All this was his portion of the cross," Stowe wrote in the abolitionist newspaper The Independent in 1862, and he took it meekly without comment. Green asked her for a new copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin so he could finally finish it. She was happy to oblige. Green and Kitty eventually made it to Canada, where they likely waited out the Civil War. But Canada was not home. By the end of the decade, the couple was back in Dorchester County. Life was hardly idyllic. Because Maryland had not been a Confederate state, It wasn't placed under the Reconstruction-era mandates that allowed black politics to flourish, albeit briefly in the South after the Civil War. But the chains had been broken. The prosecutor who had put Green in jail had once declared that slavery must be protected or abolished. Finally, the pendulum of justice swung in Green's favor. 3 years before he died in 1877, a Baltimore newspaper noted the irony. He's grown to be a respected citizen in the very country where he was once persecuted. And we'll finish today's episode with some Ask Smithsonian questions. And so one writer submits a question, did Benjamin Franklin really fly a kite in a thunderstorm? Steve Madewell, former interpretive exhibits coordinator at the National Museum of American History, says, thanks to Franklin, we know lightning is simply a discharge of atmospheric electricity, but historians still debate whether he conducted the kite experiment. That debate, however, misses an important story. In 1749, Franklin wrote a proposal for an experiment to prove that lightning and electricity are the same. That experiment involved erecting a tall metal rod to accumulate atmospheric electricity. In 1752, a team of French experimenters became the first to try it. Franklin's idea gained credibility because the French scientists, men of standing, not some British colonist, lent it to their imprimatur. Franklin would use his investigations into atmospheric electricity and high-pointed conductors to invent the lightning rod. And another reader writes, did James Madison switch over from the Federalists to the Democratic Republicans? Sid Hart, the curator of American Presidents at the National Portrait Gallery, says, no. Though Madison advocated a stronger national government, and though he was an author of the series of articles published as the Federalist Papers, he was never a member of the Federalist Party. When America's first political parties formed during the Washington administration, Madison and Thomas Jefferson helped form the Democratic Republicans. In fact, Madison opposed the Federalists, who were led by Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, and John Marshall, in his insistence that the central government's powers remain limited and enumerated. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.